Hey everyone, I'm Cam. I'm a fourth year physics student and I'll be reading the Bible for us today. Our passage is Job chapter 1. In the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys. And had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. His sons used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays, and they would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, "Perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." This was Job's regular custom. One day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright. A man who fears God and shuns him." "Does Job fear God for nothing?" Satan replied. "Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? You have blessed the work of his hands, so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But now, stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well, then, everything he has in your power, but on the man himself, do not lay a finger." Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. One day, when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the eldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were ploughing and the donkeys were grazing nearby, and the servants attacked and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I'm the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The fire of God fell from the heavens and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 raiding parties and swept down on your camels and made off with them. They put the servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, "Your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, when suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the 4 corners of the house. It collapsed on them and they left. And I am the only one who has escaped to tell you." At this, Job got up and tore his robe and shaved his head. Then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." In all this, Job did not sin by charging God.
Thanks, Cam. It's great to be with you. If you have a Bible, please keep it open in Job. And if you have one of the handouts, there's an outline on the back. Let me just sit up. I don't know whether this has ever crossed your mind. Have you ever thought to yourself, if I were God, I'd run the world better than it's been run? You might not say it out loud. It's sort of a bit rude to say it, but you've thought it, haven't you? If I were God, I'd stop the war in Gaza. 35,000 people dead. That's the population of Albany. 1 million people or more starving to death. There's a catastrophe coming. It's already sort of there. If I were God, I'd stop it. If I was in charge, COVID would never have happened. But it's been a pain, hasn't it? Those few years locked up, everything not working like it should. If I was in charge, my parents would never got divorced. All the pain and difficulty we've been through as a family, it wouldn't have happened. If I was in charge, I wouldn't be in constant pain. Constant pain is terrible, isn't it? Have you ever felt that way? If I was in charge, I'd do it differently. Well, me too. I think that quite often. It sort of raises the question, why is there so much suffering in this world? If there is a God, who cares? If God is in control.
Today we're doing something a little bit different in our Bible talk. Normally we look at a passage from the Bible and move through different books of the Bible, but today we're looking at a whole book in one go. Please relax, we're not going to just read through Job. That would take more than the 35 minutes we've got. But Job, like almost all of the Bible, is sort of a standalone in a sense. It fits together as a book. And especially Job, it's a drama with a purpose from God. And in fact, by the end of the book, we'll realise that most of what is said in Job is wrong. It's untrue. We're not going to look at it in great detail. And that's a pity, because we'll miss a lot of the sort of pathos of the poetry that's there. I hope you're inspired to read it for yourself. But let's think about the backdrop. Backdrop of Job is our understanding that this world is an ordered place because it's been created by, sustained by, a God who's thoughtful and ordered and purposeful. We know that in the physical world, you can only do chemistry and physics and geology and whatever else you're doing at uni because it's an ordered world. Things happen the same way tomorrow as they did yesterday. They'll happen again the next day in the same sort of way. It's predictable. It makes life possible. It makes life make sense. Why? Well, it's not about the immutable laws of nature. It's because of God's governance. God made this world and he sustained it. He designed it. It's not random. That's true in the physical sphere, but it's also true in the moral sphere. This is what Proverbs 12 says. The wicked are overthrown and are no more, but the house of the righteous stands firm. God governs this world with justice. He's got a clear moral compass, and therefore this world works in a certain way. We can observe it. Cruel, violent, greedy people end up being taken down, but righteous, generous, honest, caring people, they flourish, don't they? Why? Well, it's not because of karma. That impersonal force. It's because God, a personal God, loves good and hates evil. And so he governs his world with morality and justice. If you're with us when we looked at Proverbs a few weeks ago, we saw that wisdom is observing the world and how God governs it and living in the grain of how God runs his world, recognizing that the wicked are overthrown, but the house of the righteous stand firm, and therefore living with that. Acting righteously. Well, Job wrestles with life in that world. Now, it's helpful to notice that Job is not an Israelite. He's from the East. He's not living under the covenant that God made with the people of Israel. He's just a human being out in the wild, so to speak, like you or me. In a world, though, governed by God the Creator. Here's a quick map of the book. It sort of is this sandwich. It's got a prologue at the front, that's prose. It's got an epilogue at the end, which is prose again. And everything in between is poetry. And we'll come back and look at some of that. We'll go through the book as we go. The poetry expresses things in this sort of emotional, graphic way that's meant to move us and make us sympathise and understand it. And I'm not very good at poetry, I'm an engineer. But some of you will really resonate with it, I think. Chapter 1 and 2 give us the hidden agenda. We're introduced to Job in Job chapter 1 from the land of Uz. He's blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He is a righteous man. Doesn't mean he's perfect, but he is righteous before God. And he's also been blessed by God. Family, camels, sheep, oxen, a large number of servants, the greatest man of the people of the East. That is, Job is the quintessential sort of example of the wicked are overthrown, but the house of the righteous stands firm. He's a righteous man, and God is making him stand firm. But then we're taken behind the scenes, to heaven, to the place from where God governs. Job doesn't know this, but the narrator tells us about it. We're brought into the know. We're sort of omniscient. And this character, the Satan, the accuser is what it means, comes before God. And when he comes, he's some sort of rival to God. God seems actually chuffed by Job and what he's like. But Satan has a different take on Job. He's much more cynical take. Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you, God, not put a hedge around him in his household and everything he has? You bless the work of his hands so that his flocks and herds are spread throughout the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he'll surely curse you to your face. It's sharp and it's clever. He doesn't question Job's righteousness, not his actions, his externals, but his motives, and therefore Job's integrity. He effectively says Job is a fraud. He's a hypocrite. He's not genuinely righteous, it's just self-interest. His righteousness is just a tactic to get you, God, to keep blessing him. That is, there's no genuine devotion to God, no real trust in God. If you take away his blessing, you'll see his true stripes. He'll curse you to your face. Now, I think intuitively we know that anything that just, you know, we do good because there's something in it for us, it's just self-interest, that is false, isn't it? It's a faith. It is actually the way most religions work. But Satan is right. It's false. There's something just wrong about it. And it's a real question for you and me too, isn't it? To ponder for ourselves. Am I just obeying God to get what I want from him? Am I only Christian because of what's in it for me? We can't avoid that question. He's cynical about Job, but also he's cynical about God. You see, if he's right, then Job is simply using God. God is unwittingly being manipulated by Job. He's duped by his creature. God, in effect, is being scammed, and he doesn't even know it. Could that sort of God be trusted to govern the universe? Well, God says, let's test, let's see. And so the blows come raining in on Job. His camels, his sheep, his cattle, and even all his children are taken away from him, all in a day. Just bang, 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 bang. It's all gone. He goes from being the most wealthy, prosperous person in the land to being nothing in the blink of an eye. No warning, he's just smashed. And Job is shattered. At the end of chapter 1, Job got up, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell to the ground in worship. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I'll depart. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised. In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. He shattered, but he passes the test. But the Satan hasn't finished yet. And so we get to round 2. Where Satan says, skin for skin. A man will give all he has for his own life. But stretch out your hand, God, and strike his flesh and bones. Then he'll surely curse you to your face. And God says, okay, you've got free reign. But so far, it's only externals, his flock and family taken away. But now he's inflicted with sores all over his body. In his eyes, on the soles of his feet, in his mouth, under the armpits, just unremitting, endless pain. How does Job respond? Well, his wife says to him, are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die. But Job replies, you're talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? In all this, Job did not sin in what he said. But Satan knows it, and we know that the problem with pain is not the initial pain, it's when it persists. Have you ever had that? So some of us suffer some headaches occasionally. But I know if I take a Panadol, go to bed, the headache will be gone in an hour or two or the next morning. But some of us probably suffer from migraines where it just doesn't go. And that's a whole new world of pain and difficulty. And that's what happens to Job. The pain, the difficulties just persist with no reason given, no explanation. And so chapters 1 and 2 set the stage for this drama, this psychological thriller. Now, we know why Job is suffering. We've heard the discussion in heaven, but Job is totally ignorant. His enjoyable, full, ordered life has suddenly gone, replaced with a nightmare, with living hell. And to Job, it makes no sense whatsoever. It's completely opaque. He's just disorientated by the whole thing. And the rest of the book is Job struggling to make sense of that. Mainly, a big chunk of it, in a dialogue with three and then another guy, four friends who come to comfort him. One of them is Eliphaz, and here's a sample of what he says. Consider now, who being innocent has ever perished? Where were the upright ever destroyed? As I've observed, those who plough evil and those who sow trouble reap it. At the breath of God they're destroyed, at the blast of his anger they perish. You see what he's saying? He's saying, Job, if your life has been destroyed, you must have sinned big time. Because the wicked perish, only the wicked perish. So you must be wicked. Bildad says a similar thing. Surely God does not reject a blameless man or strengthen the hands of evildoers. Same story. God has clearly rejected you, Job, so you can't be blameless. So far, this is one sample, know this. God has even forgotten some of your sin. Now there's a strong charge, isn't it? You must have done so much evil, Job, that God can't even catalogue all of it. He's forgotten some of it. You actually deserve much worse than you've got. Not that they know about any sin that Job has committed, but they work backwards. They say, we know that the righteous stand firm and only the wicked perish. You're perishing, Job, so you must have done something really, really wicked. It's impeccable logic, isn't it? Applied with force. But we know that's not the explanation. We know Job is not suffering because he's done something evil. In fact, it's the reverse of that. He's suffering because he's righteous. That's why he's suffering. But Job doesn't know it. His friends don't know. God has not rejected Job, but is actually proud of him. What his friends are saying may be true in some circumstances, even most cases, but not in this case, not in the case of Job. But what's it like for Job? Well, it's pretty difficult. The pain consumes him. It dominates his consciousness. May the day of my birth perish. And the night it was said, a boy is born, by his parents or whatever. That day may it turn to darkness. May God above not care about it. May no light shine upon it. That is, I wish I'd never been born. Some of you might know that feeling. Later on, he says, why is life given to man? Whose way is hidden? Whose God has hedged him in? Who God has hedged in? He includes these rhetorical questions. Why me? Why is it happening? Or in chapter 6, the arrows of the Almighty are on me. My spirit drinks in their poison. God's terrors are marshaled against me. He knows that what's happened to him is not random misfortune. It's not just bad luck. If he's in pain, God must be responsible because he's God. He governs this world. If God blessed him, then it must also be God who's inflicting the pain on him. He holds God responsible. It's his poison. But when you hold God responsible for your suffering, that's a terrifying thing. If it's possible that God inflicts suffering on you, then what will your life be like? It's terrifying and confusing for Job. And over time, it eats him up. Although I'm blameless, I have no concern for myself. I despise my own life. It's all the same. That's why I say, he, God, destroys the blameless and the wicked. He continues to assert that he's innocent. He knows nothing that makes him deserve this stuff. And so his suffering drives him to the conclusion that God must have lost his moral compass. God has no longer got a north and south, a good and evil, a righteous and wicked. God has gone rogue. Now, let's think a little bit about this. Job is not claiming he's perfect. He admits often in the book that he is not completely perfect. What he's saying is, if I look at my life, it was going well, and then it went down. I didn't do anything to cause that. I didn't suddenly do something so evil that everything in my life should change. He racks his memory. And he comes up with nothing. Blank. Zilch. None. And so what he wants to do is go and confront God and put his case. I desire to speak to the Almighty, to argue my case with God. Job wants an audience with God where he can explain himself, and God will be forced to admit that he did something wrong, that he acted immorally, unjustly. See, what he wants really is not just a removal of the pain. He wants vindication. Though he slay me, yet I hope in him. I'll surely defend my ways to his face. Indeed, this will turn out for my deliverance, for no godless man would dare come before God. Listen carefully to my words, let your ears take in what I say. Now that I've prepared my case, I know I'll be vindicated. He knows he hasn't done anything. If he's guilty, he deserves it. But he isn't, and he can't live with the confusion. And I presume some of us know that feeling. We're victims of domestic violence, and we want to know why. This shouldn't happen to me. We see the wars around the world, and we say, God, you should stop them. Sometimes it's out there, sometimes it's very personal. Tragedy that struck our life, leaving us in ruins. And we say, God, you're the one in the wrong, not me. That's where Job gets to. And so he challenges God, come and explain yourself. Know that God has wronged me and drawn his net around me. Though I cry, I've been wronged, I get no response. I call for help, there's no justice. He's blocked my way so I can't pass. He's shrouded my paths in darkness. He gets no response from God, just cold, hard, impenetrable silence. That's oppressive darkness. Although it seems God can't be trusted to act justly, Job still clings, though, to the hope that maybe God will turn out to be righteous after all. He sort of, like he knows in his bones that God is good. And if God isn't, then who will be good? Who can bring justice? And so he longs for a chance to put his case to God, to go and complain to God, and get God to answer him. But God's left the house. He's nowhere to be found. And so chapter after chapter, Job is saying to God, God, come and explain yourself. But his friends are saying, Job, you must have done something terrible. Where is it? Come on, face up to yourself. Admit it. It's sort of like his three friends and Job are just shadow boxing. They're not actually engaging with each other. The friends are accusing Job. Job is accusing God. And no one is any the wiser. There's no resolution. And after 30 chapters of shadow boxing, a new character comes on the scene, Elihu. Elihu's a young gun. He's been listening to the others speak, respecting them in their wisdom and age. But finally, he can't contain his frustration. And he speaks as well. He says things like this, far better from God to do evil, for the Almighty to do wrong. He repays a man for what he's done. He brings upon him what his conduct deserves. It's unthinkable that God would do wrong, but the Almighty would pervert justice. Heard that before? It's exactly the same as the other three, isn't it? It gets nowhere. And interestingly, it sort of had no effect. No one ever responds to Elihu. It's almost like they ignore him. He's just there to drag the story out, to increase the tension. You want to say to Elihu, just shut up. Until finally, God speaks. What we've been waiting for all the time, what Job is longing for, happens. God speaks. The Lord answered Job out of the storm. He said, who is this that darkens my counsel with words without knowledge? Brace yourself like a man, and I'll question you, and you will answer me. See what's been happening. Job has been pressing God with his questions. He wants God to listen to his case. But now God turns up and he turns the table on Job. Instead of answering his questions, he asks questions. He bombards Job with question after question in this unrelenting barrage that goes for four chapters or so. Here's a sample. Job, can you bind the beautiful Pleiades? That's one of the stars. Can you loose the cords of Orion? Can you bring the constellations in their seasons and lead out the bear with its cubs, one of the constellations? Do you know the laws of the heavens? Can you set up God's dominion over the earth? Can you raise your voice to the clouds? Cover yourself with a flood of water when you feel like it? Do you send the lightning bolts on their way? Do they report to you saying, here we are, sir, tell us what to do? No, of course not. It's almost playful, but it's very pointed. And the answers to every question are in your face, obvious, aren't they? Job, can you do this? No. Job, can you do that? No. You got the power, Job? No. You got the wisdom to do it? No, not me. Job, do you run the universe? Can you run the universe? Do you have the power and capacity to do it? Do you have the wisdom to do it? No, Job, you don't. But I do, says God. I make it happen. I give an order. with my wisdom as I determine. But the issue is not merely the physical governance of the stars and the heavens and the rain and the storms. It's also the moral governance of the earth that's at stake. And so God says to Job, Job, would you discredit my justice? Would you condemn me to justify yourself? Do you have an arm like God's? And can your voice thunder like his? Then adorn yourself with glory and splendor. Clothe yourself with honor and majesty. Unleash the fury of your wrath. Look at every proud man and bring them low. Look at every proud man and humble him. Crush the wicked where they stand. What are we saying? Say to Job, Job, you govern this universe with morality. Can you do it? You think I've stuffed up, do you? Do you think you can do a better job than me, do you? No, you can't. We think we can. Job thinks he can. That's actually what is implied, but he can't. If we had a go, well, let's see how we go. What's going on here? How does God's speech answer Job's questions about his sufferings? Well, it's helpful to see what he doesn't answer, what isn't happening. See, what God doesn't do is actually give him an explanation of why he's suffering. We know, we've read chapters 1 and 2, but he never explains to Job, oh, well, I had this little conversation with the Satan, and this is what we agreed to, and this is how it worked out. Job is always kept completely in the dark. He never knows. Secondly, God does not give Job a chance to put his case. He just asks Job's questions. Thirdly, God does not sidestep his responsibility for what's happened to Job. He doesn't say, it wasn't me, it was Satan, it was the Chaldeans, it was the Sumerians, that they did it. No, God actually takes full responsibility for all of Job's sufferings. Job has said, God, come and answer, and God turns up and says, yes, I do govern the world. I make the rules. I bring it about. I'm responsible for your suffering. And I presume that's true still today. So if it's not those things, what is it? Well, to put it bluntly, God is putting Job in his place by showing Job that God is God and Job isn't. Job has overstepped his place. He said to God, God, you owe me an explanation. Come and explain yourself to me because I know how to run this place better than you do. And God said, no, you don't. And we say to God, come on, explain yourself, because I can do it better than you, and I will judge your actions by my standards. I'll judge you as being less than righteous, less than wise. God says, who are you to judge me? It's us saying, my wisdom is up to the task of running this world. And God says, who are you kidding? You're an ant. You're a woman. His friends who come, they think we've got all God all worked out. This is how he always must do things, how he must run his world. And God says to them, who are you kidding? I'm God. You're not. I'll govern my universe as I see fit, by my wisdom, not your wisdom. Well, the story wraps up with the epilogue in chapter 42. Job replied to the Lord, I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You asked, who is this that refuses my wisdom without knowledge? Well, surely I spoke of things I don't understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen now and I'll speak. I'll question you and you shall answer me. Well, my eyes have heard of you, but now, sorry, my ears had heard of you, now my eyes have seen you. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. Now, into carefully think about this. He's not saying, yes, there is. I did do something terrible. That's why this suffering came. What he's saying is, I've treated you wrongly, God. I repent of my arrogance in calling you to account. I repent of the way I've talked to you. Well, see, he's been like a little kid in the classroom. He's trying to prove that the teacher is wrong. How does it finish up? The Lord blessed the latter part of Job's life more than the first. He had 14,000 sheep and 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke oxen, 1,000 donkeys, and he also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. The God who has asserted his freedom to govern the world by his own inscrutable wisdom freely and wisely grants renewed prosperity and blessing to Job. Well, that's Job. we've done this sort of drone's eye view of the whole book all in one go. I hope it's encouraged you to go and read it for yourself and get into the dialogue and see the issues that it raises. But what can we learn? What's the purpose? What does it teach us? Well, it teaches us a number of things. I want to say five in the few minutes we've got left. The first is, it corrects a view of wisdom that gets hardened into rigid always. We see a pattern in the way God runs the world, and one of the things we can easily do is say, if that's the pattern, it must always be that way. That's what the friends are saying. God, you must always do it, so the righteous prosper and the wicked perish. But it's not always so. I'm not in control. We can become overconfident in our own wisdom. We've got it figured out, and we say, God, you must do it this way. The second thing it does give us some insight into suffering and misfortune. Now, we all ask the question, why? Why is there suffering in the world? The philosophy department does it. Every person who's ever suffered asks that question. And there are lots of ways of answering that question. Technically, they're called theodicies. This isn't one of those. It doesn't answer the question, why is there suffering? It does give us some answers, some hints of things. But it tells us we often won't have an answer for specific suffering. Job didn't get an answer. But it also tells us that we live in a world that's much bigger than I perceive. Job doesn't know about heaven. We're told about it. That's still true today. We don't know what's happening in heaven. We don't know what conversations might be there. We don't know how many millions of other characters are involved and watching what's happening in the world. There's a much larger canvas that we know nothing about in our lives as worms on this planet. Specifically, we know that suffering is not always because of specific sin. So what are we really? Well, we're just limited humans, aren't we? We don't know everything. We only know a very small part. I don't know if you've ever seen an impressionist painting, you know, the Monet and all those sort of guys, or you've seen huge tapestries. They're beautiful from a distance, when you can see how all the different colours and bits and threads all fit together to form a beautiful picture. But if you're right up close, all you see is a tapestry, maybe a couple of threads, a blue one and a red one. Or a painting, a precious painting, you see a brush stroke, a dark green and a white. And it almost makes no sense. And that's how we live life. Close up to a very small part of the tapestry. But God has the whole tapestry. And so we learn something about suffering and misfortune. Thirdly, we learn suffering about God's godness. It reasserts for us that there really is a huge gap between God, the Creator, and us, his creatures. In power, certainly, but also in wisdom and understanding and insight. I don't and cannot understand all God's reasons and purposes in how he governs his world. I'm too puny. And God's wisdom is way beyond me. But one of the experiences, I think, of being a uni student, if you're anything like I was as a uni student, is you come to uni and you realise how little you know. I remember somebody, a friend of mine, did a maths degree and honours in maths. And even in that area of maths, that little area of maths, by the time he got to the end of his honours, he was only up to 1920 in where maths had gone. He knew so little. And you know so little, not only about the area you're studying, but also all the other areas that are studied at university. But you can also have the flip side of that happen to you. That is, you look around the university and you think, all these clever people, all the research and study that's done, all the money that's poured into it, surely we're just on the brink of knowing everything about this universe and the world God has created. Rubbish. We're nowhere near. And we never will be, even if you could accumulate everything that everybody knows. God is God, and we are merely human. Fourthly, God asserts his freedom to run the universe in the way he decides. He's not beholden to me or to you. He doesn't have to do it the way I think he should do it. That thing we do in our minds, if I were God, well, God just says you're not. Don't go there. If I, with my limited knowledge and flawed wisdom, think I can do better than God, well, there's more than a touch of arrogance in that, isn't there? Inappropriate arrogance. No, God is free. Fifthly, it tells us something about living in God's world. The Bible says again and again, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. That is, willingly embracing that we live as creatures in God's world, and therefore recognizing what I am, ignorant and dependent and mainly pretty foolish. But also what God is. He knows all. He understands all. He is wise beyond my capacity to understand. Now, if you don't like that, bad luck. That's reality. That's truth. And so to live a life in this world is, well, it should be a life of trusting God, of trusting that God does rule this world with morality, with justice, with wisdom, and with power. But I won't always understand it. I often, usually won't understand it. And that might seem reckless. How could I trust a God if I can't understand what he's playing at and what he's doing? Maybe he's just playing games with me. Especially when it comes to suffering, like the terrible suffering of Job. It's extreme, isn't it? It's undeserved, and it seems to those involved in it, like Job, so pointless. Which should, if we're Christians, take us to somebody else who suffered. Somebody who suffered in a much worse way, more extreme way than Job. Jesus Christ. That was totally undeserved. Job admits he's not perfect. Those who knew Jesus admit he was perfect. Totally undeserved. And for those who were there, seemed so pointless. A life cut off by crucifixion, by cruel pointlessness. The disciples, after he's died, they think he's still dead, they say, we hope something would come from this, but that's the end. It just seemed so useless. Yet, what happened to Jesus was the most brilliant, wise, wonderful thing that's ever happened in the history of the universe. God the Son died in our place that we might be reconciled to God our Creator. It is brilliant. But you couldn't have figured it out for yourself. God was doing something that you would never dream of doing. You couldn't have worked out that plan, but God did, and I'm so glad he did. That is, it assures us that God is always working with wisdom and with love. I might not understand. Most of the time, I can't see. But that is true. You can bet your house on that. Job had his life turned upside down in a moment, in a flash. Can I say that might happen to you? That's a scary thought, isn't it? That could happen to you, could happen to me. Do you know enough about God now, like Job, to trust him?